There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th podcast. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in every week, and I want to particularly thank those listeners who have been kind enough to become patrons of the show. Last week, I mentioned that we are beginning a little bit of a fundraising campaign with patreon.com because as we've switched to a weekly podcast, that means we have weekly production expenses. So we would really appreciate your support. Thanks to those who have already signed up, and we would love it if more of our listeners became our patrons. You can find the link to do that at www.patreon.com/45thpod. I'm back again with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Sarah Basha.
Hi, it's Sarah Basha.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson.
All right, so like every week, a lot has happened, and we're going to start off this week with an incredible compilation of news events that Susan has put together. So Susan, I'm going to let you take it over.
Yeah, well, a few days back, I was just thinking back on how Tuesday had been such an eventful day, and I was just trying to recall the sheer mass of events that had occurred, and it turned out to be quite a lot. And after that, I decided to do the same for Wednesday and Thursday, and it kind of just got worse from there. This is an unscientific sampling of sort of the headlines and news events that in past days, in earlier times, would have taken up at least a day's news cycle, if not a week's. And yet, in the current environment, are often forgotten or never even seen by large amounts of people that are even following the news. So here is the list for Tuesday, April 11th. The FBI obtained a FISA warrant to monitor a Trump campaign advisor believed to be an agent of the Russian government. Documents reviewed by House Intelligence Chairman Nunes do not support his explosive claims that the Obama administration engaged in improper surveillance of Trump associates. The press secretary was forced to issue at least 4 clarifications on his Hitler remarks, which began with a claim that Hitler never used chemical weapons against his own people.
Amazing.
Yeah. Mm. The press secretary was forced to give an interview apologizing for his Hitler remarks because he was concerned that they might distract from Trump's efforts to destabilize Syria. The White House accused Russia of covering up war crimes in Syria. Trump stated that Bannon had never had a big role in his campaign or his administration, indicating, most likely, the beginning of the end for the Bannon era in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Tillerson asked why the U.S. should care about the Russian invasion and annexation of Ukraine.
It's no big deal.
No big deal. Trump's son said that the president had bombed Syria because his daughter had asked him to.
Okay, I didn't get that one, yeah.
Yeah, that was Eric Trump explaining why Trump had changed his mind, because Ivanka asked him. A Republican won a special election in Kansas by 7 points for a seat that had been won by 30 points in November.
The tide is turning.
Yeah. Trump announced he is sending an armada and very powerful submarines to North Korea, which is most likely going to be translated by North Korea and the rest of the world as an indication that there's going to be nuclear weapons deployed close to North Korea. The president's modeling agency closed down amid controversy surrounding its alleged exploitation of illegal immigrants. And the Government Accountability Office is investigating the Trump transition team.
That is one day.
One day.
Wow. Some of this I didn't even catch.
Any one of these things would have dominated headlines a year ago.
For at least 24 hours.
Yeah, and some of them would have been longer than that.
Right.
Wow.
Well, I do want to say the FISA warrant that you talked about, the FBI obtaining a FISA warrant, that actually was obtained that against Carter Page, right?
Yes.
But that's information that they had obtained that, I think, last summer. Is that right? And that information is coming to light now, or is it something that they got recently?
Well, the FISA warrant was last summer, and it appears that the FBI waited until they knew that Carter Page was no longer part of the Trump administration before they got that. They were very concerned about the how it looked and how it would affect the democratic process to have a FISA warrant taken out and someone part of a presidential administration.
So I just popped in this graphic that shows when a U.S. person can be deemed agent of foreign power under FISA. And I'm assuming this means that like this is, you know, when the FBI gets a FISA warrant, they're suspecting one of these things happening, and they're all kind of alarming. So yeah, there's about five different circumstances under which they might be able to get one of these warrants. And one is that if that person, that U.S. person, knowingly engages in clandestine intelligence gathering activities on behalf of a foreign power, or if they're pursuant to the direction of an intelligence service or network of a foreign power, if they knowingly engage in sabotage or international terrorism on behalf of a foreign power, if they knowingly enter the U.S. under a false or fraudulent identity on behalf of a foreign power, or if they knowingly aid or bet any person in the conduct of activities described in any of the paragraphs before, again, repeatedly on behalf of a foreign power. So this is pretty serious stuff.
So wait, so it followed protocol in terms of getting the FISA requirements, but under which category did Carter Page's stuff fall?
I don't think we have a copy of the warrant. Is the copy of the warrant public
yet? No. That's never. I mean, we shouldn't. It is a leak that we even know that there was a FISA warrant put out on Carter Page. We definitely do not know what the basis was here, but we know it was serious. This was not something that would be ever given out lightly against a U.S. person. So whatever it was, we know the FBI waited until they had evidence to show that Carter Page was not part of the campaign team any longer. And that they also had probable cause to believe that Carter Page was involved in kind of serious dealings with the Russians.
My understanding is hasn't Carter Page offered to also, like, isn't he one of the few people who have offered to give up information if they get immunity?
No, we don't know that. That's just guessing about why he's been talking so much and giving such horrible interviews.
Yeah, he's been
entertaining, but horrible for him.
I saw one, and all he said on there was he's engaged in no wrongdoing, and it didn't really go much further than that.
Well, let's see what happens in later days in this week. On Wednesday, Here's the roundup of the news. Trump explained in an interview how he had been eating, quote, the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake you've ever seen, when he told the president of China that he'd just launched 59 missiles at Iraq. The interviewer then corrected him and reminded him the strike had occurred against Syria.
Jesus Christ.
Trump told another interviewer that after listening to the president of China explain foreign relations with North Korea for about 10 minutes, Trump suddenly realized that this problem was not so easy to solve after all. Yeah, he said that out loud to a reporter. Oh, Lord.
I mean, it's like how he said, oh, healthcare is a little more complicated than I realized.
Who realized healthcare was difficult?
But that's pretty much everything is more difficult than he thought.
Trump made dismissive comments about chief strategist Stephen Bannon as him being simply a guy who works for me. Again, further indicating the decline of the Bannon era.
Yeah, and he said that he didn't know him that well, right?
Like, wait, he's not out of the picture completely, right?
Oh, he's not. He's down, but he's not out. But he's definitely in the down phase.
He's off the National Security Council.
When even Stephen Miller is trying to distance himself from you, it's not a good thing. It was confirmed that Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager before Bannon, had received several payments from Ukraine, from Ukrainian politicians even, that were itemized in a ledger. This ledger had previously been dismissed by Manafort as a fraud, but several of those payments have now been shown to actually have gone into his bank account, meaning that they were not a fraud, and he was receiving money off the books in this little black ledger from Ukrainian politicians. Manafort also announced that he was retroactively registering as a foreign agent under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. This will make him the second major Trump associate to do so after being dismissed from Trump service following troubling ties to foreign countries.
Right, because Flynn was the first one.
Yep. And the retroactive FAR registration thing, that by itself is pretty odd because it implies that you were violating the law because you should have registered beforehand and not after, like they're both doing. We also learned that on the same day that Manafort resigned from Trump's campaign back in August of 2016 due to his Ukrainian ties, a shell company that he owns got $13 million in loans from Trump-linked businesses. We also had a complaint filed with the Federal Election Commission regarding Bannon and his illegal compensation by a super PAC during the campaign.
Wow, I missed that totally.
Yeah, that got under the radar.
Where did you find that?
Millions of headlines that no longer seem to be important. Tillerson and Putin met in Moscow, despite Tillerson's denial 2 days before that there'd never been any plan to meet with Putin. Although at the time he made that denial, there actually were schedules already released that showed there would, in fact, be a meeting with Putin.
Was this meeting before or after the Syria 59 missile attack?
This was the day. This was, what, 5 days after?
Exactly.
Sorry, this was 6 days after. And yeah, of course they were going to meet. But Tillerson also ditched his press corps before he met with Putin.
Tillerson's very press shy. I mean,
Tillerson does not understand the press has a role in democracy.
Right.
Days before President Abe's visit to Mar-a-Lago, a health inspector found 13 violations in the Mar-a-Lago kitchen, including fish served without undergoing proper parasite destruction.
Okay, that one I did know about.
Delicious.
Yeah, notice that Trump didn't, like, rave over the fish at Mar-a-Lago when he fired the missiles.
Only the chocolate cake.
Yeah. White House personnel confirm that Trump is operating the White House with concern for how it affects the Trump organization's long-term viability, because the Trump family believes that if they continue the national strategies Trump has used before, the only place they'll be able to buy real estate is in Arkansas and Oklahoma.
This is kind of astonishing. I mean, first of all, for White House personnel to confirm this, and I'm guessing this is something that's like off the record. It's not, you know, like an official confirmation, but if these are the kinds of conversations that are happening, he's already preparing for his exit out of the presidency and just thinking about his company and his business.
Well, no, or his children are the ones worried because they're the ones doing the business right now. And they're telling daddy, hey, look, you're hurting us on the bottom line here. Let's stop being so blatantly nationalist and like killing our ability to enter to deals.
I don't know. It just sounds too messy on so many levels.
Yeah.
But I wonder how that would play out like with a re-election campaign. I mean, like, you know, I mean, like, they have to really balance that, because if they stop being so nationalistic, that could hurt their numbers with their base.
Well, it's already doing that. But yeah. Continuing on, and keep in mind, we're still on Wednesday, the 12th.
Okay, that's right.
Trump announced he was considering destroying the U.S. healthcare system to force Democrats to negotiate with him on replacing Obamacare.
Remember hey, wait, that? There was also an extended part of that conversation about whether or not he was going to bring in tax reform before or after, because they are tied to each other. But the question was, he wasn't sure whether he was going to introduce the tax reform before or wait till the healthcare stuff goes through, because ultimately it's taxpayer money that's going to be used for funding some of this stuff. So that was interesting. I think I saw that on Fox.
He's flipped so many times on what he's going to do it in. I don't even know where we are right now.
I'm glad one of us watches Fox.
So we also have on the
day two
debt front. No, it's still on Wednesday. Yeah, Mulvaney said it would be dishonest to say that Trump's campaign promise to eliminate the national debt could actually happen, and that it's hyperbole that was never intended to be taken seriously, or literally, apparently. Yeah, obviously, Trump was never going to eliminate the national debt, and now Mulvaney is saying, "Well, of course he's not," but you know. It was just a little white lie. And then, to start a whole spate of flip-flops, Trump decided to countermand his own executive order and reverse the federal hiring freeze, which he instituted, because that was something he did promise during the campaign and actually did do, and it turned out to be a disaster.
It lasted, what, 2 months?
So, it was supposed to last 90 days, right?
I mean, there's no possible benefit from what he was doing there, and eventually the harm got to be too much, and he reversed it. But Trump was not done there. He also decided to reverse several other positions he's long held, such as China being a currency manipulator. He announced that China would not be labeled as one, despite campaigning on a promise to do so. And also, just a mere 10 days before that, he announced that China was a world champion of currency manipulation. Trump also stated that NATO is no longer obsolete, which, as is well known, he ran on a platform that NATO was obsolete. He also decided that Janet Yellen might be able to stay after all. And so might the Ex-Im Bank, which during the campaign he promised to eliminate. What he said on Wednesday was, quote, "Instinctively you would say, isn't that a ridiculous thing?" Talking about the Ex-Im Bank. "But actually it's a very good thing. And it actually makes money. It could make a lot of money." Back to Syria, also had the U.S. government confirm that after going back and reviewing communications that were swept up prior to the sarin attack, it did confirm that Syrian military officials and chemical experts had planned the attack prior to its occurrence. In a separate briefing, a U.S. military official stated, "We know the Russians have chemical expertise in country. We cannot talk about openly any complicity between the Russians and the Syrian regime in this case, but we're carefully assessing any information that would implicate the Russians knew or assisted with the Syrian capability."
Didn't Bashar al-Assad come out in an interview and say that it wasn't it's the rebels. Him? Well, was that the next day? Was that on Wednesday?
He's been doing propaganda all the time.
Yeah.
Well, he actually said that the U.S. orchestrated that, that that was part of a plan to have phase one was apparently the social media garnering of support, and the second phase was to actually do the bombing.
And then, this was a fun one, the U.S. government announced that North Korea has a nuke ready to go for test firing, likely on Saturday. And finally, Trump stated that U.S. and Russian relations may be at, quote, an all-time low, and that, quote, right now, we're not getting along with Russia at all.
That's this must have Wednesday. Been. This must have been right before he said, "No, everything's going to be fine between us."
Yeah, that was very shortly before.
So he went to Tillerson, goes to Russia, and this statement comes after that.
Because same day,
definitely a little scary.
Well, yeah. You know,
well that didn't. It didn't. I mean, it was very clear from the Tillerson-Lavrov press conference that they were not on the same page. I mean, there's very real. To understatement of the year, conflicts between Russia and the U.S. and even having a good relationship between the two parties, like Tillerson does, that's not going to be enough to cover that gap.
I still can't get over how quickly that flipped.
Well, you know, I wonder if in part that's because it turns out that this administration turned out to be a bunch of not very useful idiots. I mean, they are not. First of all, they're. I mean, it's so transparent what has been happening with the dozens of connections to Russia, with all of these different campaign staffers and his appointees and stuff, that they're just, they did this so badly that I feel like Putin's like, you guys are just no help to us at all. Like, you're all going to go down. And he's just, I mean, that could be one reason that it's soured, other than the Syria thing.
Well, they have real conflicts. I mean, even though they, a lot of evidence now suggests there was some kind of collusion between the Russian and Trump team, that doesn't mean they agree on everything. It doesn't mean they get along on all fronts, or that their business interests are always aligned, because they're not. They very much have oppositional positions on many issues, and that's still going to come out, regardless of any cooperation between them.
Yeah, and the Guardian.
Sorry, go ahead, Sarah.
No, I was just saying that I think that the draining of the swamp actually led to a brain drain, because there's a lot of smart people that know this stuff really well in that could have been part of the cabinet or immediate advisors, but everyone sort of runs away, and I think that leaves this whole void in good policymaking advice, and that's what leads to all of this kind of schizo stuff.
So I'm actually flip-flopping on his flip-flops, and the reason I'm saying that is this. I always find it really odd, I mean, even when it came to Hillary Clinton and other politicians, that people attack people for changing their positions. And I personally think it could be a sign that the breeze is blowing one way and you're just kind of, you know, wishy-washy. But the other sign is that it could be that you got more information and you're making a better informed decision. And I feel like Trump going into this presidency, it's clear he didn't know shit about shit. I mean, like, he's learning all this stuff. He's getting all this information thrown at him. And maybe it is generally causing him to reconsider and re-understand issues and take a different position, which I think is actually a healthy thing.
If he was a college freshman, that would be great.
Well, listen, a businessman, I think one of the biggest traits of a good businessman is a person who can re-strategize and reposition himself based on, you know, performance and results and information. So I get that side of it. But the other point is, where are you coming from? If it's a place of like really weak information to begin with, then you can rock the boat way too much.
And also, why establish that like your position is NATO's obsolete when you don't know what NATO does? Or that the Ex-Im Bank should be gone. You don't know what it does.
Yeah, because he never thought
he was going to win. That's what I think.
So another thing that happened on Wednesday, and has gotten a little attention, but not nearly enough, is that video evidence was released that confirmed reports that Chechnya has opened up concentration camps for gay men, which is a very horrifying development. It's been solely. I mean, the first time I saw it, I was like, "That's please be fake news. Please be fake news."
Right.
It's not fake news, and given this onslaught of, frankly, just overwhelming and almost horrifying news from the White House, important worldwide events that don't directly involve the White House like this just don't have the oxygen they need.
Yep.
Moving on to Thursday's news. At the day's press conference, when questioned about Trump's mass flipping on his previous positions, Spicer explained that it wasn't Trump's position on the issues that was moving, it was the issues moving towards him. The U.S. dropped a MOAB on Afghanistan, which is the largest non-nuke single bomb that we have, and it's never been used before. It's not clear if Trump had anything to do with it, though, because when the press secretary was asked if Trump had authorized the MOAB, he refused to answer. And when Trump was asked, he said only that everybody knows exactly what happened, so what I do is authorize our military. Trump also took the time to tweet, "Things will work out fine between the USA and Russia. At the right time, everyone will come to their senses and there will be lasting peace." Despite the fact 2 days earlier, his administration had accused Russia of covering up a sarin gas attack to kill children. The Guardian reported that the British Intelligence Service first became aware in late 2015 of suspicious interactions between figures connected to Trump and known or suspected Russian agents. This intelligence was passed to the U.S. as part of routine exchange of information. In addition to that, intel from the United Kingdom, Dutch, Estonian, German, French, Polish, and Australian intelligence services likewise provided intel to the U.S. on connections between Trump and Russia.
Wow. Yeah, because they've all been scared about their own elections, so they know about this. They're pretty savvy about how Russia's been trying to meddle with them. So we've been warned, yes.
Since 2015.
Yep. Yes. The same Guardian article concluded, "One source suggested the official investigation was making progress. They now have specific, concrete, and corroborative evidence of collusion," the source said. "This is between people in the Trump campaign and agents of Russian influence relating to the use of hacked material."
This is huge.
Mm-hmm. And in yet another bizarre news interview, Carter Page told George Stephanopoulos he can't guarantee that he did not discuss easing of sanctions with Russian contacts, stating, "Let's see what the FISA transcripts say."
What the fuck?
Oh, does he mean let's see what I'm being investigated for, and depending on that, let's see what information comes out?
Let's see what the transcripts of were recorded of me talking to Russian agents say.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's saying, let's see what they caught me saying. If they didn't catch me saying it, then I didn't say it.
It was announced that at an American airstrike in Syria 2 days before that, 18 friendly forces were accidentally killed. A senior White House advisor left the White House and immediately joined a lobbying firm. Trump's campaign pledged to drain the swamp and would have required advisors to forego lobbying for 5 years after leaving the White House. In many cases, it turns out that pledge was either not signed, or as in this case, Trump just waived it, meaning it amounts to just about nothing in terms of actually stopping people in the White House from becoming lobbyists. The CIA director, Pompeo, confirmed that WikiLeaks was cooperating with the Russians in its interference in the 2016 election. This directly contradicts the president's frequently repeated claims that WikiLeaks was not working with the Russians, and it's also a kind of odd contrast to Pompeo's own promotion on Twitter of the WikiLeaks dumps of DNC emails.
Oh, Trump loves WikiLeaks.
Yeah. Trump got an early start in the weekend by returning to Mar-a-Lago, unaccompanied by any of his senior staff or advisors. So,
wow.
4 p.m. on a Thursday, let's start the weekend and just go alone without anyone who knows what they're doing to go with me to my private resort that my company owns. And then at the same time that Trump was landing in Florida, reports emerged that the U.S. is planning to launch a military strike on North Korea this weekend if it tries to test a nuke.
I'm exhausted going through this. This is unbelievable. This list of just 3 days worth of news coming out of this White House.
There's just no semblance of consistency, and it's all over the place in terms of the layers of different things that are unsteady.
Nothing's functioning. This is chaos. Inertia can keep us going for a while because we did have systems in place and they have managed to keep everything more or less going without a rudder. But you can't have someone who doesn't know what they're doing in charge of this much military and economic process.
I mean, the potential for damage is incredible. But this was Bannon's stated goal, chaos.
Well, I'm one of those people, I've traveled the world and I come back home every time and I kiss the ground over here because I've seen other systems and I know this is the one that works the best, and I'm putting all my hope in the system and that it'll just correct itself to, the best level it can, because, no system's perfect, but this is the closest to it that we have in the world, I think.
But systems don't correct themselves. It's only if people take action against what's happening.
Well, obviously.
By calling it out, by identifying it. And that's what's not happening here. Without strong voices in the government pointing out and working to counteract this kind of chaos, it just gets worse. And
sometimes, Susan, those strong voices are quiet and behind the scenes.
Well, here's the thing. We're actually going to talk about that because I don't know, Sarah, you might be right. But then I think, well, Canada's not too bad.
Can I tell you why? Because when I've worked on the ground here with Republicans, that is the way they deal with things. They do it quietly in closed doors and they don't do the touting in front of everybody thing. And it's sometimes it's sneaky. Sometimes it's massively effective.
I don't mind behind the backs maneuvering, but this is a basic attack on our rights and civilization. If you can't forcefully speak out against attacks on democracy, but you're quietly working behind the scenes against them, to me, that's not enough. I don't care if it's like more politically efficient.
It's a combo. I don't remember who the state rep was, or was it a senator who spoke at a town hall recently and just said Spicer needs to step down. So there are voices out there that are saying stuff.
There are a few slowly stepping up, and maybe there are more of them that are, maybe it's kind of ramping up. But the fact it's taken this long to point out the obvious is, I think it's an indictment on where our system is or was. I mean, the chaos we're seeing right now did not come out of nowhere. It was something that emerged from an already sick system that hadn't been diagnosed yet.
No, I just think we are a country of rules and law, and we have to, like I said in one other segment that we did, that we just have to let the checks and balances work out for themselves. So I don't think that we could have gotten this far without, unfortunately, some of these things having to be unraveled.
Well, I was going to say, you know, in the wake of that breathtaking list of just what happened on Thursday, I did want to go a little bit more in the depth on the MLAB, the mother of all bombs.
Massive ordnance air effect blast. Wait, what is that? Is that right?
Yeah. Also mother of all bombs. I like mother of all bombs better. But anyway, yeah. So, you know, what we've been told is that, first of all, this is the largest munition we own that, notwithstanding nuclear weapons, it is literally the most massive, powerful bomb we own. The next level up would be a nuclear weapon. It was used in Afghanistan and close to the Pakistan border, but we have been told, not just by the U.S. administration, but also by Afghani officials, that it was used on a system of tunnels that were being used by ISIS fighters. Now, only 36 fighters, according to sources on the ground, have been killed, which, number one, I'm wondering a little bit about how disproportionate this attack was, given only 36 people died, when this is a bomb that can take out 9 city blocks.
How heavy is a presence? How big is the presence of ISIS in that area? I'm always thinking Taliban.
There was reports about 600 or 700 somewhere in that area, but it's not clear how they were defined the area or what. I mean, it's a lot unclear about what's going on here.
It could just be a tactical thing to prevent a supply system or the routes that they take, regardless of who it is, ISIS, Taliban, whatever.
So, but I guess it's important to point out, too, that this is the biggest non-nuclear bomb we have, but it is massively, massively on a different scale. Like, I think it's like, what, like 0.1% of the total power of Hiroshima? It's not a nuclear weapon. And also, even though it's a very large singular bomb, we have like large amounts of smaller bombs, which would amount to the same amount of blast power. So even though it is a very big bomb, in terms of the actual effect, it's not necessarily different from more conventional attacks we've been doing all along.
Do you think it's symbolic? Because look,
I think so. I think it is.
They used intelligence that they had in real time on the ground to decide that, you know, okay, we see no civilians. Apparently, no civilian casualties have been reported, but they had to know that this is not a large number of ISIS fighters. Even like 36, they knew at least it was under 50 that were right there at the time that they dropped the bomb. So what is the point of that, other than it being like a signal that we're coming after you really big now?
Well, does that deter anything? Does the show of that kind of power deter anything in, you know, way out in the Middle East? I mean, that's my question. Is it just the show of muscle, and does it deter stuff? Does it scare ISIS?
So one thing I've been trying to follow is, so early when after they announced this attack and refused to say who actually ordered it, there were statements made that it was used to attack like the tunnel systems being used, and that it was a way to sort of take out the underground bases there. But from what I've seen, and people who actually know this stuff, the MOAB is not designed to take out tunnel systems. That's not
tunnels,
like
right?
It's ideal use. So why would you use that if that's what your actual target was?
See, I trust the military on this one. Again, I don't know if Trump necessarily knows all the, you know, nuts and bolts of it, but I trust that they know that it's part of a bigger tactical goal. And I'm not sure we'll ever know the exact minutiae and exact, you know, reasons, but you know, I'm going to count it as something that they probably know they're doing right.
But it's very, in a democracy, we need to know if we're like massively scaling up an engagement and using weapons we never used before, we should know why. There is a valid reason to question that, especially when it's apparently the military doing it on their own without any kind of direction from the political agencies, which is terrifying. That's not how the military should work.
Right.
Trump can't just abdicate his like responsibility for this, saying, you know what, generals, go do what you want to do. That's
not
going to
work. No, I'm not saying it's a carte blanche. I'm just saying that there must be something tied into it.
Saying he did.
Well, I don't think you're going to get a straight, clear answer from him anyway. He's got so much on his plate, and plus the tactical stuff is not his forte anyway.
So maybe it's not a good time to be doing this kind of attack.
It could be intricately tied into supply routes for just extremists in general.
They've never said that. I think it was psychological. Appears to make the most sense.
I think you're right about that, Susan, because from a pragmatic perspective, this is not going to eliminate ISIS. First of all, you cannot bomb an ideology into oblivion. It cannot happen. And, you know, I spent the last year doing research in Pakistan, right across the border, about the rise of ideological extremism and its impact specifically on like university campuses. And there's a lot of activity by these ideological, some of the ideological extreme groups on campuses, some of them operate openly. But, you know, there's evidence of like ISIS-inspired terrorists and violence happening like all the way down into southern Punjab and other regions of Pakistan, very far away from this border. So how far can you chase, you know, this phenomena? It's not possible. So even if this is what the military thought was a good thing to do as a tactical response to stop like the routes, it simply is not an effective strategy for eliminating ISIS, which is what Trump keeps saying that he's going to do and he wants to do. You cannot eliminate ISIS. You cannot eliminate violent extremism this way.
But that one move is not designed to eliminate. It's part of a larger bunch of moves. Come on.
But here's the danger. This, as far as we can tell, this was ordered by people involved in the war in Afghanistan. But it doesn't just affect that. We are now opening up fronts in Syria, possibly Iran, and North Korea. And all these other countries are watching that. Like, these actions have effects in the other fields. So it needs a unified plan. For instance, like, North Korea is responding to attacks in Syria. So we can't treat it as isolated engagements that each commander in each zone can handle for himself. This is why you need to have a commander in chief.
But here's the thing, Susan. So look, here's the flip side of that. Now, the president of Afghanistan actually said that he approved the strikes, that they worked in concert with U.S. forces to help, to make sure that this bomb like landed where it was supposed to. But you have the ex-president, Hamid Karzai, who strongly condemned the bomb on Twitter, and he said, "I vehemently and in strongest words condemn the dropping of the latest weapon, the largest non-nuclear bomb on Afghanistan by U.S. military. This is not the war on terror, but the inhuman and most brutal misuse of our country as testing ground for new and dangerous weapons.
Oh.
It is upon us Afghans to stop the USA." So I just want to read this one Facebook post by someone who is from Afghanistan, and I'm not going to say who it is, but he also has been working in government for a long time. He works in one of our security agencies, and this is what he posted. "Yes, the MOAB dropped on my country origin, Afghanistan. Sad, problematic, ethically challenging. Why a bomb that size? And the sheer power of the explosion will have a psychological impact on people around it for miles. But I'm not going to stop there. If you care about the Afghan people, you should know that the terror and violence caused by the terrorist organizations and their state sponsors have killed thousands and thousands of people over the years. If you cannot acknowledge the hospitals that have been blown up, the schools which have been blown up, the young girls kidnapped and killed, the police officers who have died protecting the elderly, the journalists kidnapped and killed, the death and destruction on so many women, children, and men, the psychological impact of not knowing whether a bomb will go off in your classroom, the impact of not knowing if your parents will come home. If we can't acknowledge all of that, and the only time we care about Afghanistan is when America drops a bomb, then we don't really care about Afghanistan or the Afghan people. It's our righteous indignation speaking." What do you think about that?
I think that's a terribly honest and very valid post.
Like, as we're raising concerns here, and I've heard this even in response to our, like, the activist criticism of drone strikes, you know, over the years in Afghanistan, many people on the ground say, hey, we need these, even despite the casualties.
My question is that a minimizing of foreign interference and deflecting or just taking away from that and saying, well, we have enough of our internal issues, so why don't we tend to our own internal things before we point fingers at a foreign government dropping a bomb on us? Is that what he's saying?
No, I think what he's saying is I think this particular post is in response to much of the reaction of people who are really heavily opposed to this and really concerned about this this attack in Afghanistan. And he's saying, where are you when the many other and I've heard this criticism from people who say that, especially liberal and progressive anti-war activists who don't have much to say about the internal violence and the violence committed by terrorists themselves against people. Because look, tens of thousands of people have died at the hands of terrorists in those countries, almost 40,000 in Pakistan alone since 9/11, right? But we over and over again have people who, when the U.S. tries to intervene in some way using our military might, only has criticism reserved for that and doesn't address like the actual concerns of people on the ground there.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that feels that way.
Hi, listeners of the 45th podcast. I am very excited to tell you about our new sponsor because, believe me, I wish I had known about this a long time ago. If you do any kind of business travel, pay attention. This is a huge discovery. I took dozens and dozens of business trips in the last couple of years, and I really wish, again, I had known about this before. It is the best new way to buy business travel, and it's called Upside.com. And if you're not a business traveler, but you know somebody who is, you got to tell them about it, because here's why: they're going to love it, and I love it. Every time you buy a trip at Upside, you save a ton of money, and they give you an Amazon gift card worth $100, $200, $300 every single time. And the way they do it is really clever. What Upside does is they bundle your flight and hotel together for one low price. Bundled pricing saves money, especially on business travel. So Upside gives you free Amazon gift cards. And if you're a frequent business traveler, your company saves a ton of money and you can get thousands a year just from buying your air and hotel together at Upside. Plus, you still get all your miles. You would be crazy not to check out Upside.com if you're shopping for business travel. It takes just 3 minutes to see how much you can save by buying your flights and hotel together for one low price. Honestly, I can't believe it's taken so long for someone to do it. So check out what we have arranged for you. Use the offer code BIZTRIP and you're guaranteed to get at least a $200 Amazon gift card your very first trip. BIZTRIP gets you at least a $200 Amazon gift card for free. That is BIZTRIP. How can you not do it? It's a no-brainer. Save big on travel and get a big gift card, $200, when you use the offer code BIZTRIP and hundreds of dollars every time after that. I love Upside.com. Upside.com, minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. All right, Sarah, so we're going to turn to you. Tell us what is on your mind this week.
I think the biggest burning issue for me has been Korea and the WMD threat. So before I dive into that, I'm going to put a really kind of do a layman kind of history class on Korea, and I'll try to make it really short. So the history of Korea, the issues that, I mean, how it's developed over the years has been roughly around from 1910 to 1945, Korea was under Japanese rule, and it was largely a farming state. Then in the 1930s, it became more industrial, it had heavy Manchurian influence, and the terrain was kind of, went from farming to more of industrial. In 1945, it was partitioned at the end of World War II, and in the 50s, it was a guerrilla communist leader called Kim Il-sung who tried to unify the whole of the Korean peninsula under communist rule. The U.S. intervened, it couldn't conquer the North, and it was divided by the demilitarized zone, which now separates it into North and South, and the U.S. stayed in South Korea. And then, obviously, in the 70s, North Korea wanted less reliance on communist China and the USSR at the time. There was, like, fundamental disagreements over things to do with traditional communist thinking. Kim disagreed with Khrushchev when he criticized Stalin, and it started to get more militarized in its approach. So Kim had now started a culture of self-reliance and a personality cult of his own. Then comes the 1990s when the Soviet bloc breaks up and then North Korea goes into an economic crisis. And this is where it starts to tip and spend, you know, disproportionately more money and resources on nuclear power under Kim Jong-il, who is the son of Kim Il-sung. And now we're dealing with Kim Jong-un, who is the grandson of Kim Il-sung and the son of Kim Jong-il. So what's been bothering me about the news is how close we're getting to a very dangerous situation here in this area. First of all, North Korea is now preparing for its sixth underground nuclear test. We know that. And we've started to move the USS Carl Vinson from Singapore out to the coast of Korea at this point. And Korea is calling it a reckless act of aggression. But General McMaster, who's our national security advisor to Trump, said that the need for the warships was a prudent step because North Korea has been provocative. Now, South Korea is our biggest ally. Yeah, South Korea is the biggest ally that's actually in danger of an invasion. That's always an imminent threat for them. But what we've done is teamed up with a missile defense system that is joined, and it's designed to intercept with multiple projectiles at one time. But we also know that North Korea has the ability to send an ICBM or intercontinental ballistic missile over to the U.S. at this point. We've got Japan's support in Shinzo Abe. Said he'll join the U.S. Navy, and that's because North Korea has been testing weapons off of their coast as well. And then we also have the fact that North Korea blatantly ignores its own people, and they've lived with sanctions for so many years and have had this heavily dictatorial, narcissistic regime that rules over it that doesn't even listen to what their wants or needs are. But I think the bigger threat is not just the fact that we can have a missile coming to the U.S., but it's just that uncertainty of we set out under Trump to be sort of isolationist, but we really can't be. And you know, going back to something Tillerson told Stephanopoulos on ABC with respect to Syria and North Korea.
What message do you think North Korea should take from President Trump's decision to strike Syria last week?
Well, I think the message that any nation can take is if you violate international norms, if you violate international agreements, if you fail to live up to commitments, if you become a threat to others, at some point a response is likely to be undertaken. And I think in terms of North Korea, we've been very clear that our objective is a denuclearized Korean peninsula. We have no objective to change the regime in North Korea. That is not our objective. And so the whole reasons underlying the development of a nuclear program in North Korea are simply not credible.
That indicates something contrary to the isolationism that the campaign had promised us. The biggest problem I have here is the role of China. So China's the biggest trading partner with North Korea. About 90% of North Korea's trade is with China. But the sanctions don't slow its nuclear development. So the UN had placed sanctions on coal imports from North Korea, which China had helped to draft the resolution and pass it, because one third of North Korea's economic sustenance is coal to China. So the Chinese have tried to cooperate lately, and they've sent back coal shipments, and they recently sent back a biggest fleet of coal to North Korea. But they've also threatened to cut off vital oil supplies if North Korea continues on this path. But at the same time, North Korea's, while it's completely dependent on China for that oil and it's going to cripple the economy, it still somehow manages to ignore the needs of the people and the crippling of the economy and keeps building up this nuclear power. And what Trump has done now is promise China that he's going to kind of change some of the rules of trade that they have and help China out if it helps to get North Korea to calm down a little bit. But the issue I have is we don't really know what the conversation was between Jinping of China and Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And to me, it just sounds, again, part of that, you know, back and forth. Obviously, the media's had a field trip with the fact that, you know, it looks like Trump doesn't know much about the region, and so he had to get like a crash course in it. But my bigger problem is there's things that are happening. Like after Jinping left, Trump turns around and is thinking about passing an executive order that targets China for dumping steel into the U.S. markets, because China obviously has a trade surplus with us. And then the other thing is, I mean, talk about my last segment where I said that domestic policy is heavily tied into foreign policy. Trump wants Janet Yellen back to head up the Federal Reserve because he doesn't want to rock the boat with the monetary policy and keep interest rates at a level where, you know, he can work with China. And he's, like Susan said, he's no longer calling China a currency manipulator. So I think going back to the rhetoric of the campaign, you can't stick to those things if you don't know the landscape very well. And what's scaring me is how far is this going to go to affect our domestic policy? And do we really even know what we're doing with the foreign policy? And last time the Treasury did a currency report, it was China and five other nations were called out to be on the watch list of countries that are engaging in unfair foreign exchange practices. But Trump is now going out of his way saying that China's no longer a manipulator of the currency. So the three areas of concern I have is on military might. Like, can the U.S. do this on its own? We've had a history in the last 8 years with the last administration of being, you know, light-footed in our approach to conflict. And so we're good at the electronic interceptions. We're good at the cyber warfare. And we've been doing that with North Korea all this time. But the question here is, Trump has put $54 billion extra into the military, but it's still very unclear how he prioritizes his defense spending and where it's going to go. Some people...
Is it unclear if you think about the fact that last week we've had Syria, Afghanistan, and now imminently an attack on North Korea? Is this unclear now? I mean, is there not a clear Trump
doctrine? We don't know where it's going. We actually don't know how he's spending it.
Actually, the Center for Defense Information is, Smithberger, Mandy Smithberger. She said that the combination of some of the spending cuts and then the federal hiring freeze and all that other stuff put together, that $54 billion is actually just taking away from domestic agencies and giving it to the DOD. It doesn't necessarily say that it's going to Army forces, Navy fleets, and, you know, closing that readiness gap. So I'm worried about that. We might not have the boots on the ground that we need, and we don't know if those appropriations are going out to the right places for us to handle a conflict like this. He still hasn't said where he's going to be putting that money. It's just going blank out to the DOD. So that's another question. And then I have issues with trusting China too much. I mean, obviously China's been, you know, to a large degree, China has vetted North Korea by making it so dependent, and they're so codependent, but largely so, North Korea on China, with this trade stuff that's been happening. And so it has regional control of that area. And I think at this point, we are so beholden to China in terms of making sure that it doesn't get, North Korea doesn't get out of hand. Obviously China has a trade surplus, and it's been accused of devaluing the currency, its own currency, to affect the way our markets come across. But also, there are ways, like even though China sent back the fleet of coal carrying ships, there are ways for them to do this in a backhanded way to keep that coal coming in some way. So I fear that sometimes. I'm hoping, because everything on the outset looks like China's cooperating, but there are ways that they can break that. So to some degree, I just feel like Trump has to walk a very fine line between vetting China and making sure that it's going the right direction, but at the same time monitoring that the trading doesn't happen, because let's face it, China does need what it needs from North Korea, and North Korea is heavily dependent on China. My other question is, you know, how much...
Can I say something about the trusting China thing, though?
No, go ahead, say it.
I mean, I wonder if, you know, all of this is going to, like, come down to Trump having a good meeting with somebody. He hosted the president last week. He's given high praise to the president of China, and he seems to really like it. He said he's a great guy, and I feel like, you know, this is the way that we have maybe some foreign powers might be able to undermine U.S. policy vis-a-vis them, because I think they're recognizing that all we have to do is get in good on a personal level, have a good meal, have some good chocolate cake, praise this guy, and we could get him to trust us. And when maybe I don't know. I just feel like this is how, like, Trump turns on a dime. He has a good meeting, he likes a person, and suddenly, oh, all of a sudden, he's got a different stance on policy towards that country.
Yeah.
And don't forget that China gave Trump all those lovely trademarks he's been wanting and couldn't get because they're not available to him. Well, long story, but suddenly trademarks he shouldn't have, he does have, and they're worth a lot of money.
Right.
Well, my thing is, you know, is Trump a statesman or just bombastic and confused about the regional history? And, you know, you're using that kind of language in the campaign, making promises, when actually you don't know the delicate balances that you need with allies in the region to prevent conflict from escalating. So that's what scares me, is how is this going to play out? Match that up with what's happening in Syria. And I'm also thinking, you know, we don't have to just worry about South Korea being invaded, or what role will Japan and China play in this North Korea problem, but also what happens to NATO. He said it was obsolete at some point, and so now he might need NATO, what, you know, in the G7 countries. So to me, it looks like if we don't know what we're doing, that's even more ripe ground for other nations to play us.
He doesn't know what he's doing. He has no plan. He is reacting on new knowledge he learns, doesn't quite hopefully grasp some of the time. And people with their own interest in certain spheres of the world are making shots that affect other spheres, and there's no coordinated campaign between them. We are fucked. Seriously. Like, this is not ending well. This is ending in a horrible tragedy. I don't see any way out.
Yeah, and can we really win wars with cyber warfare and electronic? Because McCain gave a, you know, like a detailed defense budget in January of this year that would take care of like the army, the navy, and closing that readiness gap. But I don't see where it's going when it's just being blank given to the DOD. Is it being appropriated for the right thing? So can we actually handle this plus Syria plus other challenges?
No amount of money would help us deal with the war on that many fronts.
Yeah, and I think China, China's role globally, economically, is very powerful. But also, if it's affecting our domestic policy to the point where Trump has to think about our monetary policies and our interest rates and all of that based on that. I mean, of course, it's always tied in anyway, traditionally. But he's having to flip-flop and go back to things and try to, you know, stabilize stuff at a domestic level in order to be more powerful on the world stage, then you can't deny that domestic and foreign policy are heavily tied together. And if somebody doesn't understand that and is going out using language that's very fiery and I'm trying to win support based on promises that, you know, that look like they're just basically trying to garner support without any backing or any knowledge of the situation, it's dangerous.
Well, I think he definitely is trying to show like an overwhelming kind of potential for, like, you know, and this is actually tied to his campaign promises that, you know, the world is going to respect us again. We are going to have the strongest military. We are going to win. And but at the same time, there are people who supported him because they thought he's not going to be interventionist. He's not going to be a hawk on these issues. He's not going to keep committing our resources and military to more engagements overseas. But I feel like, you know, I don't know if it's an ego thing, but he is doing some really heavy military aggressive posturing here with this move on North Korea. And I don't know if the North Koreans are the ones we want to test on this.
Well, the other thing is, even if you try to say that the MOAB in Afghanistan was designed to just kind of scare people, how does that relate to anything that they could use on North Korea anyway? So
I don't think those were connected because, they're not. The people don't care about North Korea. That's not what their concern is.
Yeah.
So how many things are we handling on how many fronts?
So we are going to move from the international train wrecks that are happening to some domestic stuff that I've been keeping my eye on for a number of weeks now. We have not been able to get to just because Syria happened last week and now there's so much stuff happening overseas. But I think it's very, very important because it's not just about what's happening outside our borders, but we have to not drop the ball on what's happening inside our borders. And I want to focus, number one, on Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, and the tremendous damage that I think he is doing and attempting to do in this very short period of time. Quick primer on Jeff Sessions. You know, Jeff Sessions, he began his illustrious career kind of as a public servant, as a U.S. attorney in Alabama. And he has always been very, for some reason, obsessed with like drug cases and corruption also was, although he didn't have a great track record of anti-corruption convictions, but his zeal for drug cases when he was a U.S. attorney in Alabama decades ago resulted in a federal drug conviction rate 4 times the national average. So that should tell you how laser focused he is on drugs. He don't like drugs. We know he wants to go after legalized marijuana in the United States too. And also, you know, his career is marred by his connections to racist organizations, to his support for policies that are inherently racist. And when he was nominated to the federal bench by President Reagan, he was blocked by Congress because of a case called the Marion Three and charges of racism. He became the Attorney General of Alabama, and he also was slammed for prosecutorial misconduct, a high-profile case. So in many ways, he does not have a really clean legal record, I would say. And as Attorney General of the United States, he isn't performing so well. So, for example, we know that on the immigration front, you know, his Department of Justice is not doing well in the federal litigation against these executive immigration orders. They keep losing on this litigation. And as he is the Attorney General, this is kind of a point of embarrassment, I think, should be for him. 2,000 attorneys across the United States have signed a complaint to the Alabama State Bar asking that Jeff Sessions be disbarred because of his dishonesty and basically lying under oath during his confirmation hearings. So he doesn't have a great start, but here's what he's trying to do. And remember, again, he says that he is the law and order attorney general. And this is how he is going to enforce his position as a law and order attorney general, and that is by primarily supporting law enforcement and not law itself, is what I would argue. Number one, he announced that he's going to have the DOJ do a review of the consent decrees that have been reached under the Obama administration with 14 different jurisdictions, which now have consent decrees. And for people who don't understand what that is, these consent decrees came into existence because the Department of Justice would look at a jurisdiction like Baltimore, for example, we'll talk about that briefly, and say, okay, there's some serious systematic issues in this policing agency, and there are maybe abuses that are happening. And so we're going to come to some terms with you guys. We're going to force you to reform, okay? Then the irony here is this. The DOJ stepped in and said, we're going to force these jurisdictions to implement certain reforms, right? They had to work with these cities and states to do that. And now the DOJ is backing off and saying, well, you know what? We're going to review these consent decrees that we forced you to enter, right? Because it's not that these cities wanted it necessarily at the beginning. But now the same cities that have been forced or initially, you know, like forced to become partners and implement these reforms are saying, no, you know what? We want these consent decrees. These reforms are important to our citizens. They're important to better relationships between law enforcement and the communities that they police. And they're asking the judges who have to enforce these consent decrees, Your Honor, please go ahead, sign the consent decree, force us to do this, make us do this, while the Department of Justice is saying, no, we don't know if we really want this anymore. In Baltimore recently, the Department of Justice said, you know what, they asked the judge, give us 90 days to review this, we might not be interested in all these different reforms, and the judge actually said no. The Baltimore City Solicitor said, no, we don't want any more review. We want to go forward. Everybody's ready for this. The Baltimore Police Department even has said, you know, we've worked together on this. We are ready to go forward with these reforms. And the DOJ is like, no, thank you. So one of the questions is like, you know, why does Jeff Sessions want to roll back these consent decrees? And he says that they vilify the police. Mr. Sessions said that the agreements were demoralizing to the police and they could generate a rise in violence and murders in some large cities, which is a contention that's been challenged by many criminologists. So his only concern really is about how bad this makes the police look, and not necessarily the impact of these reforms in terms of, like, you know, what experts are saying, and even the jurisdictions themselves, they're conceding that, yeah, these reforms would help us actually fight crime better. But his support from law enforcement unions and other kinds of agencies is, and I think this is just kind of his history. I mean, like, people are saying that these are, that reviewing these consent decrees, is this another way of showing his racial bias, because he knows that many of these systematic abuses that have forced, like in Baltimore, the consent decrees came after the death of Freddie Gray, you know, the killing of Freddie Gray. And for those of you who know, you know, Susan and I have another podcast called Undisclosed, and we have spent the last year and right now are in the middle of a season examining that, the killing of Freddie Gray. But in the wake of Freddie Gray's death and then the uprising and the riots in Baltimore, this consent decree came about. It came about because of the really, really unethical police practices towards Black communities in Baltimore. So there's that. There's a consent decree issue. You guys have any thoughts on that? That's just the beginning of like a shift, like a sea change in how the DOJ is going to handle so many things.
There'll be a lot of changes. Sessions is going to remake the DOJ into his old-style Southern law and order vision.
Well, I'm thinking overall in terms of criminal justice reform and the focus on marijuana versus hard drugs that are actually a bigger problem, the heroin and opioid epidemic. And I'm wondering if mass incarceration issues are not being dealt with properly, because that's when, I mean, most of those people that do suffer the consequences of bans on marijuana are disproportionately from minority communities. And I'm wondering why that's being focused on more than the actual bigger problem.
I mean, why is he focusing on sort of rehab efforts in rural areas for different demographics and focusing on incarceration for marijuana users in the cities? I mean, I got a theory.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious.
Tell us.
There's clearly a racial bias here. I'm not saying he's trying to lock up minorities, but he is very focused. I don't think in his mind he puts it into those words, but that is what he sees as the problem. He views the problem as lawless minorities who are doing all kinds of bad things like smoking marijuana and causing our hellish wasteland we're living in or something. Because
eating
you know
too many Doritos.
What he wants to do is to create a very harsh, expensive police state where the police have authority and must be trusted implicitly. And it's worth the cost to lock up lots of nonviolent offenders.
Well, listen, I don't think it's the actual attack on recreational drugs like marijuana that's the problem. I think it's the crimes that result from that type of behavior or that type of, social
fabric. What kind of violent crime?
You start to talk about money. You start to talk about exchanging it because it's become, we have that. How many ounces is it in D.C.? It's like an ounce or 2 ounces. And I'm wondering if it's not so much the recreational use of it, but the types of criminality that it could lead to. And I think if he's trying to address that, then it's a larger law enforcement issue. But I don't see otherwise why marijuana would take such a precedent over the bigger problem of heroin.
Well, I think it's the same reason that these consent decrees, which are focused and all about urban communities, it's the same reason. There is a racial demographic that is impacted here, and he is going to be harder on that racial demographic. It's going to be about people of color. That's what it's down to.
Well, now, I disagree with you, too. I don't think he's innately so hateful. I understand the track record. I understand those things, but I think
Is it important that a racist realize he's racist? Yeah. Is, I guess, my question.
Like, when you meet with these people, they're, I haven't met with Jeff Sessions, but I have a feeling that he would be a pretty reasonable person.
He's a nice guy. I know people who've met him. Everyone says he's a very nice guy. That doesn't mean he's not a racist.
I don't think he's out to get it. I think there's underlying issues that come from dealing in drugs, whether they're recreational or hard drugs, and there might be two different levels of issues, but they do exist anyway. So going back to my personal view, even if it's at risk, there should be none of these things happening that we're seeing on television. Those are egregious, wrong, outright should not be happening. And there's a bigger social problem there, definitely. But I don't think Jeff Sessions is out to get people that way. I think it's been blown out.
See, the thing is this, and I actually urge you and our other listeners who are really interested on why the police practices are so problematic, and how they are designed to criminalize average normal behavior like hanging out on your front steps, is actually to listen to Undisclosed: The Killing of Freddie Gray. And I'm going to give you an example. I recently moved to a fairly affluent community, but it is mostly a community of color. In fact, a friend of mine, and if you know anything about the D.C. region, Potomac area is a very affluent community. He came to visit and he said, "Oh, you live in Black Potomac now." I thought he was being funny, but I kind of do. So this is an affluent area. I tell you, I have never seen such a police presence in an affluent white community. This is a community of people who are clearly upper middle class with $500,000 and up homes, okay, professionals. And the other day we were driving down the street, okay, in a matter, I swear to you, of two blocks, okay, six cars were pulled over, okay, on a very quiet road, six blocks. Every single car we passed was somebody in a very nice car, but a person of color with like one cop behind them. I could not believe the police presence I'm seeing in an affluent Black community here. And that's what we're trying to get at. It's really about how You're not going to see, you absolutely not going to see that in an affluent white community. You're not going to see that many cops out on the road pulling over people like that. And so it's very, very disproportionate. The kinds of leeway the police have in urban black communities and their policing, like, you know, all kinds of behavior is criminalized, and that's the issue. And that's why these consent decrees are important. But we do need to move on. So I wanted to talk about this because this is very important to me as somebody who, you know, and Susan as well, you know, we think and we work on wrongful conviction cases. And this is this is really going to impact the issue of wrongful convictions. And that is that Sessions announced he is going to end the Commission on Forensic Science. Okay, the National Commission on Forensic Science is an independent panel of scientists, law enforcement judges, and defense attorneys that was created by the Obama administration in 2013. It was created to review the reliability of forensic science used in trials, okay? Instead of having this national commission, what Sessions wants to do is he will appoint somebody called a forensic science advisor, one person, and he's going to move all of these questions about forensic science and their reliability into a task force at the DOJ for violent crimes, okay? They're also suspending a review. The DOJ has been reviewing the testimony of forensic scientists, like in hundreds of different trials. They've been reviewing this for a couple of years, and they're going to suspend that review, okay? That review began in 2015 when the FBI actually admitted that dozens of their own examiners had given flawed testimony in hundreds of cases, right? So why was this commission established? It was established because many people believe that forensic science is not real, actual science.
Believe that.
Right. Scientists believe that because actual scientists believe that. Because science means it has been, like, you know, tested in labs. It has all kinds of, you know, all the different scientific methods to make sure that something actually is scientifically viable. Whereas forensic science has developed after, like, kind of investigatory practices that the police over years developed, okay, we think this is some kind of evidence. And it's not, scientists believe it's not evidence. In fact, the President's Council of Advisors on Science, they issued a report that reviewed lots of commonly used forensic methods that we've all heard of, like hair analysis, bite marks, shoe prints, and they've revealed a, quote, dismaying frequency of instances of the use of forensic evidence that do not pass an objective test of scientific validity.
There's no empirical basis for much of forensic science. And you know what? It's very possible if there was testing, they would find an empirical basis, but they have not looked for it thus far for many fields. It's simply a sort of a history of investigators doing certain things and saying it's a match without any kind of scientific analysis behind it.
And some of it actually has been disproven, like bite marks, like hair analysis, right?
We know gunshot residue.
Right. But these things across, like from state to state, they are actually still used. But this commission could have helped eliminate the use of this faulty, quote, scientific evidence. So eliminating this commission is really problematic because what it's going to do is it's going to allow prosecutors to continue to use this kind of evidence in front of juries who don't have any idea, who are really impacted by the CSI effect, which convinces them that this shit is real. And it's going to lead to more wrongful convictions.
Yeah, this is a disgrace. It's purely designed to improve their conviction rate. And it's not just against, I mean, prosecutors should want to have this stuff validated. They should want to have their cases strengthened by knowing what has a sound scientific basis, what does not. But if you're the DOJ and you don't want to deal with your backlog of cases and suddenly have old ones coming up and being like, oh, wait, this was invalid, you want to make sure this forensic testing doesn't come under question.
I have a question because I'm not an attorney. You guys have dealt with this stuff in terms of evidence in cases and stuff. But you know, when the government's faced with having to streamline expenses on certain things, and you know that Trump's been trying to do that, you know, across the board, does eliminating this kind of a thing streamline it? But also, does it give, I mean, is there an alternative that could keep a tab on the types of information that prosecutors are going to be using? And that's my thing. Where's the check there? It's just like the Planned Parenthood talk. Like, if you're going to eliminate federal oversight or some level of federal, what would you call it, a safety net, then at least give some sort of a replacement of it so that there's still some safety for the general public. So in this case,
but they don't want the safety. That's the problem. The only thing, bipartisan in that it had, you know, people from all aspects.
Non-controversial, non-political. Yeah.
And it's only here to investigate and give a voice to and synthesize findings. You can't replace that unless you do the same sort. I mean, you could reorganize it, but it's not that kind of issue. They don't want to have it full stop.
Well, then would states or, I mean, not states, but I guess would individual localities kind of localize it and find a replacement of their own? I mean, how would that work?
It doesn't make sense to do it. I mean, this is basically, it's science. Why have a state-by-state science? Like, you want to have, I mean, if forensic science is a science, which I think is a unestablished question at this point, then you want to have a robust national or international conversation on methods, on findings, on reliability.
Yeah.
This isn't something that makes any sense to like say, oh, you know what, this local county needs to do its own independent analysis of whether their like testing of mixed DNA samples is actually scientifically valid.
Yeah, and if you privatize something like that, it could lead to more egregious behaviors in the sense that you're paying to have information, receive information, and so it could be skewed.
And it's unenforceable. If it's privatized, it wouldn't be enforceable anyway. I don't know how this would have been enforceable. I think it would have been a signal at a minimum.
To research and investigate and learn what we know. It was to try and sort of organize it into a real science because, I mean, actual scientists aren't doing this. So there's not like a sort of peer review community that can develop and validate these findings, which this was kind of a replacement for.
And the reason it was being done like this is because it is very, very difficult. I mean, we don't have a centralized law enforcement structure, right? Where it's like, you know, there's something, certain policies are put in place in law enforcement and filters all the way down into our local communities, state by state, jurisdiction by jurisdiction. I mean, like, that's why it's so difficult to implement this across the board. And having a commission like this, at a minimum, it could have produced the kinds of stuff that defense attorneys could use, like, you know, to push back on in different cases, you know, against the use of some of this evidence. I think it would have been very important. But also, this is a signal, again, it's like the pro-law enforcement, pro-prosecution. This is a win for prosecutors and law enforcement at the end of the day.
Because it's not just about looking into forensic science. It's about actually organizing and making more efficient databases and to sort of coordinate the national law enforcement community in ways that could help prosecutors too.
Yeah, and I think it's part of the streamlining, guys. And I don't know where it falls in the priorities, but obviously it isn't one.
It's not. It's not the expense here. It's definitely not streamlining. It's purely they don't want to have the stuff questioned.
Like, this is ideological.
There's no cost basis for this.
Yeah, this is ideological. I'm pretty sure this is not a commission that demands a sizable chunk of money. We're going to wrap up this week's episode now. We've gone through a lot, and thank you to our listeners for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you next week. Bye. Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support, so please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled Patreon. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
When did you tell
me? Well, but I'll tell you.
Before dessert?
But I will tell you. Only because you've treated me so good for so long, I have to tell you, right? I was sitting at the table. We had finished dinner. We're now having dessert. And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen. And President Xi was enjoying it. And I was given the message from
So what happens,
the general. As I said, we've just launched 59 missiles heading to Iraq.
Well, you headed to Syria.
Yes, heading toward Syria. And I want you to know that. Because I didn't want him to go home. We're almost finished. It was a full day in Palm Beach. We're almost finished. And what does he do? Finish his dessert and go home. And then they say, you know, the guy you just had dinner with just attacked the
How
country.
Did he react?
So he paused for 10 seconds. And then he asked the interpreter to please say it again. I didn't think that was a good sign. And he said to me, anybody that uses gases, you could almost say, or anything else, but anybody that was so brutal and uses gases to do that to young children and babies, it's okay.
He agreed.
He was okay with it. He was okay.